Good evening. I'm actually Shannon S. now. I need to make that little change. No, you're fine. No, I was Shannon B. I got married last year, so I'm a Shannon S. now, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is July 16th of 2009, and my home group is out at Lake of the Woods, It's the Monday night group. And I remember being here before, and I remember you come in, and as soon as I walked in the door, I thought, they don't do, like, a bunch of readings or anything. Like, you get in, and you're, like, right up there. Like, I mean, immediately. And I look around the room, and I see a lot of familiar faces that have heard my story. So feel free to nap. I won't be offended. Billy did say that, you know, we could just put on one of my old tapes from when I was here before, and then I could actually listen to myself. But I guess that would be the point, right? So I'll have to try and stick to my story as best I can. I apologize. For some reason, my eye seems to be watering. So if I keep going like this, it could be because I'm crying. You know, I might cry when I talk. But anyway, like I said, my sobriety date is July 16, 2009. And I'll give you a little bit of background. I grew up not far from here. I grew up in Northern Virginia in Burke. And I grew up in a very typical household. My parents will be married 58 years this year. And I have an older brother who's 6 years older. And my parents are not alcoholics, and my brother is not an alcoholic. And I did not grow up, you know, you hear a lot of stories. I mean, we've all heard them, and I hear these stories of people and their upbringings and things that happened to them in their childhood. And I remember thinking, I know why that person drank. Like, I get it. Like, that makes sense. And, of course, that's not the reason people drink. But when you first come in, you know, you're looking for that reason. And I didn't have any of that. I mean, I had a great upbringing. I had a great family household. And it was really your typical, we lived in a townhouse, dog and a cat and a son and a daughter, and it just couldn't have been more typical. I can remember, and when I say my dad was an alcoholic, he was the type that, when it was football season, he'd buy a six-pack of beer, right? And we lived in a townhouse, and on the bottom level was where he was able to go and watch TV, and there was a refrigerator down there, and he'd put the six-pack in the refrigerator, and he'd drink like two, you know, on football Sunday, and then there'd be like four left over for the week after, you know. And but I remember when I was maybe about 7 or 8, I don't know, I was young, and I went to him and he was drinking a beer, and I asked him for a sip of his beer, you know, like, what's that? Can I have a sip? And him thinking probably, well, this will cure her of ever wanting to drink. You know, he said, sure. So he gave me a sip of it, and he did manage to cure me of one thing. I never drank Stroh's beer ever again. No offense to the Stroh's drinkers. It could have been Milwaukee's Best or Pabst Blue Ribbon. It probably would have been the same. But anyway, that's just my first experience. And it was just that brief, you know. But then a few years down the road, when I was about 14, which seems to be, I hear that age bounced around a lot, especially for girls. It seems like that around that time seems to be kind of a pivotal age for us. And I had one of my best friends, she had 5 older siblings, and so there was like a lot of beer around, and I remember that was really when, about that age was when I first started drinking on the weekends. And it's funny how when we get sober, we can look back at some of the behavior, and now it makes sense. You know, I remember the first time one of the first times I drank, and it was a 7 and 7, and there was a guy, we were at a park, and this guy was making 7 and 7s in these big gulp cups, right? And so he was making them really strong, and I remember I took a sip of it, and it burned really bad, you know, and it tasted horrible, and it was just like, and where anybody else might have put it down, I immediately thought, well, I have to drink it really fast, right? Because then, I mean, that, and to me that made sense. Like, the thought of not drinking it wasn't an option. It was, well, this tastes bad and it burns, so I have to drink it really fast. Looking back, that wasn't, you know, everybody else there, you know, most of them put it down, you know, or were like, hey, this is too strong, or hey, you know, and not me. I just drank it really, really fast and proceeded to get drunk. But for the majority of my teenage life, I drank. And if there was never an option to drink, I always drank. And on the weekends, there was always alcohol around. When I was 16, my parents actually bought their first house down here at Lake of the Woods, and it was a weekender. And so they would come down on the weekends. So I'm 16 years old. My brother is now 22, and he's left the house pretty much. And so I'm alone, and my dad was like, there's no way we are leaving our 16-year-old daughter here. And I had a 20-year-old boyfriend at the time. They were like, there's no way we're leaving her here on the weekends. We're taking her with us to the Lake of the Woods. And my parents thought it was going to be a great idea. They got the lake house, right? They had no phone, like no TV. They wanted it to be like a lake house, right? Like no communication. And so my dad was like, we were going to have no way of getting a hold of her. There's not a chance. And my mom was like, no, we can trust her. And really, my mom wanted to go be with my dad by herself, you know. And I think back, when I was 16, my mom was like the age I am now. And I get it. Why would I want to bring my 16-year-old when I could go be with my husband and be like alone for the weekend, right, at a lake house? Like, I get like the whole mindset, right? Yeah. So, but my dad, you know, he was firmly against it, and my mom won that argument, as usual, like she normally did, and so they left me home. So I was home alone on the weekends with my boyfriend and with my friends, and, you know, so I drank every weekend, and I didn't really have any consequences my entire teenage life, but basically where I'm going is that it never occurred to me to not drink if drinking was an option. And I can remember my best friend, in fact, I was telling Scott this the other day, I was thinking about it, and she has never been a drinker, and it was very fortunate for me because she was a designated driver, and she didn't mind, and she was the one with the five older siblings, but she just did not like to drink, ever. It had no appeal to her whatsoever. But I can remember we would be at parties, and I would think, how is she not, like, not having fun? Like, I mean, like, it baffled me that she would not get how much more fun we were having drinking, like how she just didn't catch on, right? And I remember every time she'd take like a sip and we'd talk her into, she'd take a sip and I'd go, oh, now she's going to get it. Like now she's going to see. And no, she, you know, she just didn't see. But, you know, thinking back, I can just remember that baffling thought of why people wouldn't drink. Like it didn't make any sense to me. So anyway, that was pretty much my entire childhood, you know, and that was when I, and that's how I drank my entire teenage life. And the one thing that I did learn, I graduated from high school, you know, just basic average, you know, and this is when I learned that, you know, I never had a problem being mediocre. I really didn't. And I say that, and it sounds weird, but I always felt like if you were the best at something, where did you go from there? I mean, I always did. Even when I was younger, I never strived to be the best at anything because I thought, where do those people go? Like, once they're the best, what do? You can't become the best of the best and then the best. I mean, you know, then you – so, and then I never wanted to be the worst at anything because that sounds sad. But being right in the middle, mediocre, was very safe. Like, nobody really expected too much, but nobody was ever really disappointed. You know, and I seemed to catch on to that way before, like, anybody else did. And I always thought that that was a cool thing to be. So I graduated from high school very mediocre. My choices were fairly limited. But one thing I did learn from my brother, who was 6 years older, was he did go to school, and he went to George Mason for a semester, and he decided that playing golf instead of going to class would be a better option. And so he failed his first semester, and he had to pay my parents back all the money. And I can remember him writing those checks out to my parents and seeing how that frustrated him. And then he ended up going off to the Army right after that. So I knew right away that I knew about myself that if I had tried to go to college, I really did. I knew I would fail. I knew that I just wanted to do what I wanted to do, and I wanted to party, but I wanted to make money. And I didn't mind working. I had always worked. I had a job. You know, I started babysitting when I was 12. I got a job when I was 15. So I went to a business school right out of high school, and I got a technical kind of a degree from Washington Business School, and I started working. And so I was 19 years old. I got a full-time job down in Old Town Alexandria as a secretary. And I call it a secretary. You people call it all sorts of different things, but I've always said I was a secretary, and that's exactly what I was. So I'm working in Old Town Alexandria. I'm 19 years old, and I don't know if any of you are familiar with Old Town Alexandria, but it's a really, really cool place to be if you're young and you drink, because it is like one pub after another, right on the waterfront. It's very fun. So I'm working, and this is where I learn all sorts of new things about drinking. Like there's, you know, that you can drink at lunch, you know, like I learned that. I learned that happy hour was every day. I learned that. I learned that, you know, I had one of the guys that I worked with that he had a briefcase that we called it court dates because he could fit 4 quarts of beer in his briefcase and sneak them back into the office, right? You know, so we learn all these new little things. And so, but again, it's like I'm starting to realize that I don't drink. Like when I would talk to my friends from high school, I'm just starting to realize that I drink differently than them and I drink more often. But this is when we start doing what we all do, is that we start saying, well, I'm not getting into trouble. I'm paying my bills. I'm responsible. I get up and go to work. You know, I don't get in fights. Everything's good. So this is when that whole process starts. So, but I can remember, and it's funny how things stick in your head. I can remember I was sitting at my boss's desk, and he was 36 at the time. He was my boss, and I remember thinking he was so old. It's so funny. And, you know, I'm looking at him, and he was looking at me, and we're going over some reports, and I'm drinking. I remember because, of course, I'd gone out, and I'm hungover, but I'm just drinking this huge, giant glass of water, right? And I'm trying to do these reports, and I just keep taking this water. And he looks at me, and he goes, Shannon, he goes, did you go out drinking again last night? And I go, yeah, it was Tuesday. Like, yeah, you know, like, of course I went out drinking. I mean, again, why would I not go drink every night? Like, why would I not go drink? So I got out drinking, but I remember he looked at me and he said the strangest thing. He looked at me and he said, Shannon, he goes, you got to be careful, your liver. And I thought, ew, that is the strangest thing to say to somebody. Like, why would you talk about my liver? I mean, it baffled me. For one, I thought it was creepy, okay? But two, I thought, what does that have to do with drinking? I mean, I really did. I had no clue. I had no concept. The thought of, like, physical problems from drinking made no sense to me whatsoever. So, but what's funny about that is that that day and that thought and that memory has stuck in my memory ever since. I mean, I can remember what I was wearing. I can remember what he was wearing. And it was almost like God said, I'm going to stick this memory in your memory bank because this is going to be useful later. So anyway, a little time goes on, and basically it's the same thing. I drink, there's no consequences, and a little more time, and I end up going, I meet a guy at a bar, go figure, but he actually was working at the bar, and now I'm actually working part-time at this bar. I'm a waitress, and I meet him, and we end up getting married, and I like to call it my starter marriage because, you know, sometimes we need one of those. And so anyway, we get married, and it was a short marriage. I was young, and there was multiple reasons that it didn't work out. But I do know that he was the first person that really called me out on my drinking. And he actually said to me, he said, you have a problem drinking? And he said, will you go to an AA meeting? And I knew nothing about AA. And I said, sure, because I came from a family. My parents had been married for a long time. And I didn't get married thinking – I got married thinking I'd be married forever. And so I thought, well, sure, if he wants me to go, I'll go. And I'm a people pleaser, so that's what I did. And I went to this AA meeting down in Alexandria in this big, huge – or Annandale, or I can't remember exactly, but this big, giant church. And we went down into the basement, and people were smoking, and there was a smell of coffee, and everybody was very friendly. And I remember it was a speaker's meeting, but I don't remember – I couldn't tell you if it was a male or a female speaker. I couldn't tell you. I just remember that I sat there, and it was a bunch of people, and I remember at the end of the meeting they asked if there was anybody that was new, and I did not say I was new. I did not say my name. I did not – because there was like this thing in my head that said, don't say it, because once you say it, there's no going back, you know. And I wasn't prepared to say it. I just wasn't. I was there – and I remember he was furious, but I remember being a little mad, too, because I was kind of like, well, I came. I mean, I did my part. I came to the meeting. Like, in my head, I'm thinking, I never said I was going to stop drinking. Like, I mean, so anyway, but that was my very first little taste of AA, which was a million years ago. So anyway, so that marriage doesn't last. A little time goes on. I'm working. And so now, here's the interesting thing, though, that now looking back is, like, alcoholic behavior, which is, you women will appreciate this, is that once that marriage ended and I started to think about dating again, I made this little mental note, mental list in my head, and you know how we do. And it's like nowadays, of course, with all of the websites and date sites, people can actually go on there and check what they want, what they don't want, you know, all this stuff. And so I had this in my head. And, you know, most of us as women, you'd think we would be like, okay, unemployed, good hygiene, you know, nice family. All those things you would think would be at the top of your list. And I had those, but the very top of my list, I made a complete mental note in my head that the next guy I dated had to drink at least as much as I did. He had to. I mean, that was like my drop. That was like, that was a deal breaker right there. If he didn't drink as much as I did. That's not normal thinking. That's not normal thinking. I mean, a normal woman doesn't go out and thinks, you know, at the top of her list is somebody that has to drink as much as I do. But, you know, in my favor was there's a lot of drinkers out there, so there was people to date, and I ended up finding somebody, and I actually found a guy, and he did drink as much as I did, and he was a wonderful person, and we got along great. We had a lot of things in common. He came from a great family, and he was a hard worker, but he drank. He didn't drink necessarily the same way that I did, but he drank just as much as I did, and we were the type of people that we would come home from work and we would start to drink the minute we walked in the door, and we would drink till we went to sleep. and we drank on the weekends, and we started to drink earlier on the weekends. But there was no, and I also was never one of those people that ever said, I'm just going to have one, or I'm just going to have two. That never made sense to me either. It wasn't until later, way later, that I tried to stop drinking, you know, that I tried to, like, you know, minimize it. But when I was younger, that thought never crossed my mind, because it didn't have to. I mean, it didn't have to. So I drank until I went to sleep. And I would say I drank until I ran out, but we never ran out. I mean, we made sure that there was always enough booze. So anyway, so I ended up marrying him, and he, like I said, he was a wonderful person, and we ended up we're married a few years, and I get pregnant with our first child, and I did manage to stay sober throughout my pregnancies, which of course, as women, that was another thing that I said, well, I can't be an alcoholic, because who can go with 9 months without drinking and, you know, be an alcoholic? So you know, that's another one of those little things we tell ourselves. So I get pregnant with our first son, and go to the hospital, have a baby, and okay, so here was the thing, is that, and this is another thing that looking back is odd. Women, you understand that when we get pregnant with our first child, it's like we look forward to the baby shower, right? It's like, oh, gotta have a baby shower, gotta get all the baby stuff, gotta, you know, my mother would call it nesting, gotta set up the nursery, gotta do all this stuff. So that's all great. But when I figure out that, so basically what this is they're gonna have a big party with all my family and friends, I'm not going to be able to drink at it. And I thought, that doesn't sound like any fun. Like, why would I want to be at a party when I can't drink? So I didn't have a baby shower before the baby came. I said, nope. So I figure we got to have a baby shower after the baby comes so I can drink. This is crazy, right? So, but I need, like, a theme with it. So then I start looking around, and I hear about these parties, these things that they do in England, and they're called sip and sees. And they're actually parties that people have after the baby comes. Now, they still have the shower before the baby, so they can get the baby stuff. But I'm thinking, what do you need? Like, it's a little baby. Like, what's he need, right? So I wait, and I find this thing called a sip and see. And I go, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have a sip and see. And but I rename it, and I call it a chug and hug, right? I rename it, and I actually have invitations printed up with me holding my son right after he's born, and it says chug and hug on it. And this is the invitation to my baby shower. It's called a chug and hug with a little picture of a beer and the baby and the whole thing. And I think this is a great idea. And here's the alcoholic thinking, is because there is still a part of me that's a little surprised that it hasn't caught on. Like a little bit. I hear about sip and sees, and I still want to go. Like, I get the invitation for, you know, somebody's baby shower, and it's got baby bottles and teddy bears, and I'm a little disappointed. I still think, I cannot believe that my chug and hug has not caught on yet. But see, that's the craziness of my obsession to drink was so bad that I had to reorganize the whole baby shower thing that people, women, have been doing since the beginning of babies. I got to redo that whole thing just to suit my drinking. Anyway, so we have the chug and hug. I have the first baby. He's perfectly healthy. He's beautiful. And of course, I'm not drinking, but I realized that somebody brought a bottle of champagne. I think it was my mom brought a bottle of champagne to the delivery room. And so we're having the champagne. And of course, then it occurs to me that they allow you to drink in the hospital. And I was like, they're not like telling us we got to take the champagne out. Well, I stayed onto that memory too. So a few years later, we get pregnant with the second child. And now I'm a little more prepared. Now I realize they're going to let me drink. So I've got minis packed, and I take them to the hospital, and the whole – it's ridiculous. So then we get to the third child. Well, by now – this is 3 years later. By now I'm pregnant with the third child, and now it's really insane. And so a month before he is due, I start packing my bag to go to the hospital. And I'm packing minis in here and in there, and I repack it like 20 different times, because then I start to think, well, what if somebody opens up my bag? Because even though they're not technically going to arrest me or kick me out of the hospital for drinking, it might look bad. So I've got them wrapped in like clothes. I mean, insanity, like absolute insanity. You don't start packing your bag to go have a baby a month before you're due, and you're figuring out where to stick the minis in your suitcase. That is not normal thinking. It's not. But it doesn't occur to us at the time. Like, it really didn't. I'm thinking it's good planning. I mean, I'm honest to God thinking I am a good planner. I'm not thinking there's anything wrong with it. So I've got all these minis packed, and by the time I got to the hospital, I kid you not, I think I had like 30 minis packed in my suitcase to go have a baby. And it doesn't occur to me This is odd. So, but it occurs to me that I shouldn't let everybody know about it. That it occurs to me. So anyway, so we get to the hospital. We have our third son, and he's healthy, and he's beautiful, and he's perfect. Again, and I'm blessed because, you know, nowadays, I mean, it's like the things that can go wrong now, and, you know, how I managed to have these three beautiful children. And so anyway, so everybody leaves, and it was a very quick delivery, and everybody leaves the hospital. And so it's, you know, everybody's been gone an hour, and it's quiet, and it's like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I start to think, okay, now's the time, right? Now's the time. So I get my mini out, and I have my little son, and he's all wrapped up in the little papoose because they got him all, like, tight in that little thing. And I prop him up on my knees, right, and I'm in the bed, and I get out one of the minis, and I drink it, and I sit there, and I wait. And I wait for that buzz that we all search for, that we continue to search for, that warm, tingly feeling that comes up over our arms, and that, you know, that warmness, that feeling of, like that little comfort that we get when we drink, that we search for forever, that we never, ever get again. But I think every time, I've been good for 9 months. Like, I deserve it, right? I've earned it now, right? So I think it's going to come. So I wait, and so here I am looking at this perfect child, and instead of feeling like love and joy and relief, and I feel disappointment. That's what I feel. Is like I'm sitting there feeling disappointed because I'm not getting the buzz that I think I deserve. But I remember at that moment thinking, there's something wrong with feeling this way. It's one of those other little memories that I stuck back there thinking, this isn't right. Like, I shouldn't be this disappointed that I'm not getting a buzz at the hospital after I just gave birth to my son 3 hours ago. So, but that's the alcoholic thinking. I'm not thinking that it's just that strange, but I held on to that memory. So come home, and then, you know, now I'm just, we figure we're going to coast. You know, my husband works, and by now I'm a stay-at-home mom. I've been a stay-at-home mom since our first son was born. And, you know, and the drinking got earlier and earlier. It got earlier and earlier during the days, of course, during the week. And it was like noon, and then it was 11. And this is when I actually started thinking, today I won't start drinking till 2. You know, today I won't start drinking till 5. Today I'll wait till he actually gets home. And, you know, and then this is when it started with that never played out. You know, it was 12. And then it was 11:30, and then it was like, well, if it's 11:30 and I mix it with orange juice, does that really count? That's kind of like, you know, that's like a morning drink, so that's not as bad. I mean, it just, but those are the things, and those are the obsessive things that we just always think about. You know, we're constantly making ourselves feel better, and just it's this or it's that, or, you know, well, it's not so bad if you do this, and that's what we do. I mean, that's what we do. So we're about 7 months into our third son is 7 months old, and my husband is diagnosed with ALS, and it completely, like, out of the blue. I mean, just because I had lived this life where I had never dealt with anything really bad, like, in my entire life, besides, like, a dog dying. I mean, I had had this very normal, typical life, and I had no coping skills whatsoever. And I thought that I did. You know, I grew up in a good house, a good home. I grew up with, you know, and so you think that you will know how to handle things. But, you know, I will tell you that until, like, I will never, I can't say never because we still do this, but I mean, I work really hard at not judging other people for what they're going through and how they're dealing with things. Because until you really go through something, you don't know how you're going to deal with it. And when my husband was diagnosed with ALS, we were at the doctor's office, and it was like there was a line drawn on the calendar that day. And it was like before he was sick, and then he began to die. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, that's exactly what happened. And the next day, he began to die. I mean, we spent the entire, that was what it was happening in our house. And so I did not know how to deal with it except drink at it. I mean, that was the only thing I could think to do. And at the time, I wasn't thinking I was drinking at it. I mean, I just didn't know what else to do. And I stopped eating, and it was just the anxiety and the sadness and the sickness that was going on in our house was so thick that it speeded everything up. And here's what I always say is, and when I first came into the rooms, I didn't even really like to talk about Mark that much. And I was very careful, and I didn't really like to talk about his illness very much in the beginning because I never wanted it to sound like an excuse. I never wanted it to sound like I was trying to say that I drank because he was sick or that I started to drink all the time because he got, because that wasn't it at all. Do I think that, I always believe and I still believe that I would have ended up where I ended up. It may have taken longer, but I think that sometimes in life our circumstances accelerate our process for us. And that's what I think happened. Because it did. I stopped doing anything else that was any good for me, and all I did was drink. And so I became very sick. And thank God, my parents lived right across the street from us. They still do. I mean, our driveways line up. And they lived right across the street. And, you know, when we first built the house there, it was because we were thinking we were going to have to take care of them, you know. And really, God put us there because they took care of us. And so my kids spent most of the time over at my parents' house because it was just a very, very, very sick household. And I drank all the time, 24/7. I would wake up with a shake so bad that I would have to drink. Towards the end of my drinking, I mean, my hair was falling out. It was very thin. I bruised. I was yellow from head to toe. My eyes were yellow. I threw up nonstop. I could not write my name. I could not go to the bus stop. I could not. I could barely function towards the end of my drinking, and it was a very, very, very sick environment. And I would go into my closet, which was weird. And here's the other thing that's funny is I couldn't take my kids to the bus stop, but I could get to the liquor store every other day. We could manage that. And I would have to drive like this because I was constantly seeing double. It was all the time. I was seeing double all the time. I shook all the time. And so I would drive to the liquor store like this at 10 o'clock in the morning, right, just praying. Luckily, it was like 2 miles away, praying that nobody would see me. And I would go in and I would buy two half gallons and two minis, okay, every other day. And it was ridiculous because why did I buy the two minis? Because I had to drink those on the way home. Because drinking right out of the half gallon would have been ridiculous, right? I mean, that would have looked bad. I mean, how would I look if I'd actually taken a swig out of the half gallon, you know? But see, this is the thinking. So I have these minis, so I drink those on the way home. So anyway, so I drink in my closet most of the time. And here was the other thing is I would drink these shots, and I still put it in shot glasses, and I would drink the shots, and I would drink Gatorade. And that was the only thing I drank. I drank Gatorade all the time because I was convinced that the electrolytes in Gatorade would balance it out. Like, I'd be fine, right? I'm only drinking alcohol all the time, and I'm sick, and everything's just – but it's okay. I've got a lot of electrolytes coming in, so eventually it's going to balance out. I mean, this was the stupidity. This was the things that we think that are normal, and we try and convince ourselves we'll be okay. So I would wake up after like a half an hour of sleep because I would start to shake and sweat so bad, and I would go into the closet, and I would get on my hands and knees, and I would pour a shot, and I would hold it in my hand, and I would take the shot really quickly, and then I would pray if I could just count to 10 without throwing the shot right back up, then I could take another one, and then that would give me about 45 minutes of a little bit of a reprieve. And that was my cycle. But half the time I didn't make it. Half the time I would be throwing up in my closet. Like, I mean, it just... And I say this because it's true. And people won't, like, we wouldn't make this up. Like, I wouldn't make this up. But this was the cycle that my life was in all the time. And so, and I had this, you know, my sponsor says, you know, to pray for moments of clarity for people. And I get that. I completely get it. Because instead of when I first got in here and I would pray that people would get it and I would pray that people would get sober and I would pray that people, my sponsor says, pray for moments of clarity. And I completely understand because right towards the end of my drinking, I was in my closet. And I was trying to get down on one of these shots, and I'm shaking so bad, and it's just horrible. And I had this clear vision, like clear as day. And it was my oldest son, who was 9 at the time, but the vision was he was 16, and he was talking to a friend, and it was a very, very quick, and he said, yeah, my dad died of ALS when I was 9, and my mom drank herself to death 6 months later. And as quick as it came, it went. But I can remember it. It was like, and so I know what she talks about of moments of clarity. And I feel like I believe God put that there because it has stuck with me. And I didn't want to die on my kids. I did not want to die on my kids. And so I ended up, my mom ended up calling the hotline. And it was because it was bad. And the jig was up. And, you know, everybody knew. And my brother-in-law, thank God, also had moved in with us. He'd been living with us about a year to help take care of my husband. And me and the kids because, you know, we all needed taken care of. And my mom called the AA hotline. And this woman picked up the phone just doing service work like we do. And after a couple of minutes being on the phone, she said to my mother, she said, Dee. And that's my mom's name. My mom went, oh, my God, how does she know my name? Like, I didn't give her my name. Like, who is this? And the woman broke her anonymity to my mother. And this was someone that my mother had known for years. But my mother did not know she was an alcoholic and did not know she was in the program. And it just so happened that this was the person that was answering the hotline that night that happened to know my mother. And she told her, she said, tell Shannon to go to the meeting at Lake of the Woods. She'll be okay. And I don't know what they said. I don't remember. It was like the Charlie Brown teacher talking, like the wah, wah, wah. I don't remember a lot of the first month. And I remember getting a name with a list with names, a wearing one with names on it, and there was 11 names on it. And 9 of the women on that list I still know today, and I still, yeah, I mean, 9 of the 11, and which is pretty amazing. But anyway, and I went to the meetings, and I went to the first meeting, and when I first started to go, I was so sick, and I just didn't want to die on my kids. And if I probably hadn't had my kids, I'd probably be dead, because I just didn't want to die on them. And I was willing to white-knuckle it, and I was willing to be sick, and I was willing, because I figured that was my lot in life. I figured I'd done it to myself, and I figured I'm going to be thrown up. I'm not going to be able to write my but I was just like, just tell me how not to die on my kids. And so I came to the meeting, and the other thing that struck me about the meetings was that when I first came in was that my drinking wasn't the big deal in the room. You know? It was like where everything, you know, at home it was like, you know, there's a man dying of ALS, and my drinking was like the thing that everybody was like worried about, because they couldn't do anything about him, and everybody was worried about me. And so I remember coming to the meeting and thinking, wow, you all are like, okay, you drink a lot, we get it, you know. And it was just very normal. And so I kept going, but I would go 3 times a week, and then I would go home, and nobody pressured me in the beginning. Like, nobody said, you gotta find a sponsor and you gotta go to 90 and 90, and nobody did that to me in the beginning. I'm not saying that people shouldn't do that to other people, but it was more like every time I came back, people were like, oh my God, she's back. Like, she didn't die, or she didn't. I mean, honestly, it was like that bad. And so people just kept thinking, she's back, she's back, she's back. And I was about 2.5 months into the program, and my husband passed away. And I will tell you that I had just this brief amount of time with this fellowship, but it was amazing, like, how the people and the things that we say and everything just stick in your head and start to get in your heart and start, and they're like there, you know, like these. And so my husband, what happened was that, you know, the morning that he passed away is my boys, who were still living in my parents' house, had come back home in the morning, and they were 2 and 5 and 9. And I decided to make pancakes. And I hadn't made pancakes, and I don't even know, like probably years and years and years. And I get out this stuff, this pancake mix, and it was probably too old to even make pancakes anyway. But anyway, so I got this stuff, and I've got these 3 kids, and my husband was like maybe 10 feet away, and he was in a chair, and he had a CPAP on, and the whole thing. And we're making pancakes. My oldest son looks up at me, and he says, Mom, he says, Dad's machine doesn't sound right. And I knew then, I could hear it right away, that there was air coming in, but there was no air coming out. And I knew it was gone. And the reason that I bring the story up is because I had just enough AA to hold it together. I had just enough of you people's heads, voices in my head, telling me to breathe, to pause, you know, to focus on what was important. I had just enough that day didn't turn into a disaster for my kids, because it was, you know, it's about them. And I had a really, you know, we come in here, we do the steps. And I'll tell you, when you come in and you do the steps, and the steps, going to the steps was not a process for me where it was like everything was just forgiven or everything went away or the character defects are, you know, because, you know, I heard somebody speak last night, and I still got character defects. They're still there, you know. I mean, it was like all this stuff. And we have to forgive ourselves. But I will tell you that, like, the whole, you know, after I got sober, the thing with, you know, not being there like Mark deserved at the end was one of my biggest things that I had to fight with. But what I've come to realize over time is that I may not have been there as well as I could have been or should have been through a lot of his sickness, but because of this program and the fellowship, the very last things that man experienced in life, the very last sounds and sights and smells that he experienced were me and his kids making pancakes. And that's not so bad. That's not so bad. But I've come to realize that over time, and it makes that easier. You know, after that, I, and see, obviously you can tell that still, it's still hard. But sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And that's what I said. When you're going through the steps, if things don't come quickly, don't worry about it, because sometimes they don't. Sometimes we have to go through a process of a lot of different things. So after that, I really threw myself into this program. I mean, I really did. I got a service job like right away. I mean, somebody said to me, I think 5 minutes later, they were like, she's the coffee maker for the Wednesday night group. I mean, I started doing service work. I did get a sponsor. I started going to more meetings. I started getting connected with people in this program. I did everything that was suggested of me. And I didn't have somebody saying, you should do this or you should do that. But I had all of these people, and I stuck with the winners. I mean, I followed the people. I immediately gravitated towards the people that looked like they were happy and had some time, and what were they doing. And those were just the people that I gravitated towards, and I linked onto them, and I just did what they told me to do. It was very simple. I didn't think that anything didn't apply to me. I didn't think that any of the steps didn't apply to me. I didn't think that doing service work was beneath me. I didn't think that help, I mean, none of it, it was okay. I just walked around shaking my head. And I got better. And I can remember it was like, and I'll tell you what, I still to this day am grateful that I can brush my teeth and not gag. Still to this day, right? I mean, I'm still grateful that I can take my kids to the bus stop because I couldn't do it before. I'm still grateful that I can write my name and it's legible because it wasn't legible for quite a long time. I couldn't eat a meal, you know, and these are all things that I still to this day am grateful for. I do a lot of service work. That's me. And I have gone from being a coffee maker to being a GSR to being a DCM to now I do service work at the area level, and I love it. It's not for everybody, but I will tell you that I believe service work is the core of my sobriety today. I do all the other stuff too, but generally, if I am asked for service work and if I'm asked and I can, then I do. I was taught that by my first sponsor. My current sponsor believes that. If I'm asked and I can, then I do. You know, it's not going to be, if I can't come, it's going to be for a very valid reason. It's not going to be because it's inconvenient. It's not going to be because I'm too tired. It's not, you know, I will come and I will help because this program saved my life. So I do a lot of service work, and I will tell anybody else, I say, get involved. Get into the middle of this program. You know, find your sponsor. And the other thing is, when you find your sponsor, find one that you connect with. Okay? And don't be afraid that if you don't connect with that sponsor that you can't get another one, because it's a very personal thing. And that was one of the things that I was so grateful that I didn't jump and get my sponsor right away, because I might have picked the wrong one and I'm a people pleaser. I might have stayed with one for a long time that I didn't really connect with, and I may not have been as thorough when I did the steps. It's okay. You know, your sponsor is just another alcoholic. You know, they're not signing a paycheck for you, okay? It's okay if the relationship doesn't work out. You're not married, you know, but find a sponsor that you are comfortable being open and doing the steps with, okay? I call my sponsor. I see her at meetings, but I have a set time that I call her, and I do that because that makes me accountable. I do that because if I don't get in the habit of picking up the phone and calling her and having that conversation be comfortable, if my ass is on fire, I'm not going to call her. If you're not in the use to getting and talking to your sponsor and having it be comfortable, 9 times out of 10, when you need to call your sponsor, you probably won't do it. Call your sponsors. Have a relationship. Have a one-on-one, you know, have that connection with your sponsor. I have a service sponsor today, which I got when I got into service work at the area level. And that's because I do things in areas that my recovery sponsor isn't as familiar with, and she doesn't see me in those things. And so I also have a service sponsor, which is invaluable to me, but I have these two amazing women that I can go to, you know, so I use them. So get your sponsors and use them. Get connected with people in this program. I have a home group. Home groups are vital, and we know that. But if I missed two meetings, if I miss one, they're probably going to ask where I'm at if they don't know. But if I miss two, if people didn't know where I was at, people would be looking. People would be looking for me. If you go to a home group every week and you're not there and people don't know why you're not there, they will want to know. You don't want to be that person at a meeting that you have been to for 2 years and then all of a sudden you stop going and it takes people weeks to figure out that you're gone. And you come back in like, hey, I'm back. And people are like, where'd you go? You don't want to be that person. You want to be in the middle of this program. It is the safest place to be. You know, go to meetings. I have a set group of meetings that I go to, and I have my home group, and I have a couple of that I go to. I probably could go to more, you know, I don't know. When I do the steps, I've done the steps a couple times. I did the steps the first time with my sponsor, and I've done them a couple times in a I did them in a step study, and I go through a few of them with my current sponsor every once in a while, you know. And for me, the first step was easy. You know, I was lucky. Once I actually comprehended the first step, it was very easy for me because there was no doubt that my life was unmanageable, and there was no doubt that I was powerless over alcohol. Absolutely not. You know, and it's funny. I'll tell you another quick story is that after I'd been sober a little over a year, and these are the other alcoholic thinkings is that, you know, my husband, who at the time was my boyfriend, had come over, and he was coming, but I had gone into my attic space for some reason, and I don't even know why, but I went in there, and I found two huge garbage bags filled with empty bottles of Bowman's vodka, okay? I mean, half gallons. Two gigantic ones in the back underneath the Christmas tree or something, the Christmas garland, right? And it's so stupid. Like, the effort that it took for me to put them in the bag, to go into the attic space, to put them behind the garland, why didn't I just throw them away? But that's the alcoholic thinking. Like, I don't even know why they were there. And I had thrown so much away over time to think that there was still stuff in there. So I go, I pull them out, and I immediately think, oh, my God, I got to get rid of these. He's coming. He's coming. Like, what's he going to think? I had been sober for a year. But that fear of being found out, that fear that we're still, like, doing the wrong thing, that we're bad people, that we're alcoholics, was still there. And I made myself put him down. I made myself wait. And he walked up, and I was just so teary-eyed. And he was like, what's wrong? And I thought, and I opened him up, and I showed him, and he just looks right at me. He says, did you not think you drank that much, you know? And I said, no, I did, but why didn't I throw them away? And he's like, who cares? Let's throw them away, you know? But it's like that, it takes us a while to get into these new habits of being normal people, you know? And the other thing that was, and here's the other thing, I've been there for a couple of years, and I have a Suburban, and I remember the console where the cup thing was all, like, nasty, and he said, well, that thing pops right out, you can clean it. I remember he popped it out, and I looked in, and it's, like, all vacant and empty down there, and my immediate thought was, man, I could have fit, like, 2 or 3 half gallons down there. How did I drive this car for 9 years and miss that? Honest to God. And this is the thought, that is the first thing that came to my head, is how did I miss this hiding spot all those years? I mean, the instant, can you imagine me driving around like with a swish swish of like the sound of light and just being like, I don't know what that is. But you know, that's that thinking that comes into your head where you're, I mean, and it's still there, you know. But so, you know, I didn't have a hard time with step one, obviously, you know, and I didn't really have a hard time with step two or three. You know, I have I always had a God of my understanding, and I do call him God, and I had left him. He had never left me. And, you know, and I think that was, you know, when he put that image of my son, you know, that was a clear indicator that he was still there, because I absolutely believe that he put that there. And, you know, I choose today how far away I am from him, because he stays in the exact same place. You know, he doesn't move. It's like we choose to move. And if you're struggling with step three, or if you're struggling with a higher power, and that's none of my business, and that's fine, because some, you know, it's different for all of us. But I will say this, that I know when I was out there and I was still drinking and, you know, my family was so worried, there were a lot of people that were praying for me. There were a lot of people that were praying for my family. I wasn't praying, but they were praying. So if you're in a seat in here tonight, just be open to the fact that maybe you're here because someone else was praying for you. You know, and I had somebody tell me once that we all have a higher power, we just don't all know him yet, you know. And just because we don't know him and we don't know that he exists doesn't mean he doesn't. We just haven't found him yet, you know? And that's just my take on that. You know, steps 4 and 5, you know, those are always fun, but you got to do them. You know, luckily for me, I didn't, my world had gotten very, very small, and I was a homebody. My husband was a homebody. And so basically my list of a lot of things that people that I felt had harmed me, and that, you know, it was small. It really was. You know, like I said, I had a great childhood growing up. I didn't have a whole lot of people that I felt had done me wrong. And I didn't have a whole lot of resentments. You know, my biggest resentment was probably towards myself. And, you know, so then we get to steps 6 and 7, and you know, we go through the character defects and the shortcomings, and we figure out. It was funny. It was interesting to listen to a guy speak the other night, and I didn't realize that because Bill doesn't use the same words, that it was he doesn't like to use the same word twice. So it was like talking about the same thing, but it was character defects and shortcomings. So I remember for a year I got stuck on, what's the difference? You know, but anyway, but we still have them. You know, I still have them. I pray that they're useful, you know, and that's, but, you know, and there's a lot of ones that I think we keep because they're serving us a purpose somehow. So, you know, 8 and 9, and I didn't have a whole lot of, a whole lot of things I had to say to make amends for. Luckily, my biggest amends that I had to make were to my parents and, you know, to my family. And that's where the living amends comes in so great for those of us that get sober and we still have family members that are alive, is we can continue to make that living amends. I can be a good mom today. I can be a good daughter. You know, my mom, my parents who were so worried about me that they would not leave the house at the same time for the last year of my drinking. They would not leave their house because they were so afraid that something was going to go wrong, even if they just went to the store. You know, and now they're traveling all over. And, you know, my mom was diagnosed with metastatic melanoma this year, and it's stage four, and I can be there with her. I can go to her doctor's appointment. I couldn't have done that. You know, she would have been taking care of my kids trying to deal with this, and she's not today. You know, and step 10, I love. You know, who doesn't love step? You know, we learn how to say we're sorry really quickly, which is great. You know, it's like that personal inventory. How was my day? You know, that helps us sleep better at night. You know, we can go through that day and go, what did I do today? You know, that's going to help sleep better. I sleep great at night. I mean, I literally will, like, lay down my head, and I can be asleep in, like, 3 seconds. And that's because of step 10, you know? I mean, it really is. It's because I try not to leave a lot of stuff on my plate. I try to make amends when I need to right away. Step 11, you know, prayer, that's a great one too, but I'm not somebody, I remember I got, you know, when I first got sober, I got all these meditation books because I would hear about people that would get up, like, you know, a half an hour early, and then they would sit and they'd read all these meditations, and I'd get up a half an hour early and I'd just clean the kitchen, you know? It was like, I couldn't, you know, that wasn't for me. But I do a lot of meditating. I do a lot of talking to God when I'm in the car. I do a lot of talk. I mean, I talk to him all the time. You know, it's like a constant conversation that I'm having. But I don't, you know, everybody has to find the way that they meditate, the way that they pray. And that's okay. But figure out how you're going to talk to your God of your understanding. You know, step 12, again, that goes back to me. You know, it's a lot of service work. It's a lot of being connected with other people. I don't sponsor a whole lot of people, and it's not that I haven't made myself available. I think that, like I said, I think it's a very personal thing. I do think, and it's not because alcohol is my entire story, like my entire story. And we have a lot of people, especially younger people, that have dual diagnosis, and they have, you know, there's multiple things that are going on there. And that's okay. And that's the reality of the world that we live in. And so we have a lot of women sponsors that are really good women sponsors that they have that drugs and alcohol combination, and they're familiar with it. And I think a lot of times, because I'm so not familiar, and that's okay. People need to find who they're comfortable with, who they can recognize, you know. I also don't want to tell people what to do, but that's just, you know, so I'm kind of like okay with that, because I ask my kids, I'm bad at telling you what to do. So, but when I do sponsor people, I tell them, I go, listen, I'm not going to be one of those people that will be like, you need to go to a meeting today. I might suggest it, but I'm not going to call you up, that's not the person that I am. But I find that we find where we are best of service when we're willing to be of service. God will place us where we're needed. He will place us where it is good for us. You know, whatever that may be, you know. But I believe if we make ourselves open to the people and the process and the service in this program, we'll figure out where we're supposed to be, you know. And so I have an amazing life today. You know, when somebody says, I have an amazing life and it's all because I drank too much. I do. I have, you know, that's somebody else who says that, but it's so true. I mean, I have an amazing life. I mean, you know, I have a relationship with my kids who are now, who are 17 and 14 almost 14, almost 11 and 17. And they're great. They're these incredible people, you know, these incredible young men that I would have missed. Like, I mean, I literally would have missed it all. You know, the other thing, when I finally stopped drinking and I went to the doctor and the jig was up, and it was like, it wasn't like how much you drink. It wasn't like, oh, two or three. It was like, I drink all the time. I mean, I at least went in the end going and saying, I know I drink all the time. And the other thing that I didn't mention was that I detoxed at home in my parents' house for 3 days, and I don't recommend that to anybody. Because I got very, very lucky, but I was terrified of going into a rehab because I thought it was like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Nurse Cratchit was going to come out and it was just going to be like straight jacket and I was never going to see my kids. And I got very lucky that something really bad didn't happen, so I would not recommend it. But I do know this, that detoxing, if I had known how painful it was going to be, I'd be dead because I would have put it off. I would have put it off because it was probably one of the most painful experiences 3 days I've ever been through. I mean, physically painful. So, anyway, I'm sorry, I digressed there for a second. But so figure out where you need to be in this program, you know, and make yourself available. But I have this life today where I can be there for my parents, and we travel together. We're getting ready to go on vacation with my parents, you know, next week. And I have this great relationship with my kids. I have friends today that I would have never had before. I mean, really, really, really good friends that care and listen and, you know, that we do things with and we're there to support each other, you know. I had a, you know, when I lost Mark, I had never, the thought of ever getting remarried again or even, like, having a relationship was not even anywhere in the cards for me. And, but, you know, they're not my cards. They're God's cards. So, you know, I did meet someone. He's in the program also. We're in recovery together, and he 13th stepped me a little bit, but I don't recommend that either. For us, it worked out, okay? For us, it worked out. But you know, it's part of the story. But anyway, it's a great relationship. We've been together for a while now, and last year we got married. And you know, he gave me a fairy tale, you know, and that's what this program does. I mean, it literally was an absolute fairy tale. And I remember thinking, how did I get here? Like, I remember the wedding day thinking, how did I get here? You know, from being the person that was throwing up in my closet and on, you know, and dying. You know, and the other thing, my bilirubin count when I first came in, the normal bilirubin count is 0.05 to 1.2. Mine was at 17. And my doctor said that she'd never seen anybody above 20. And within 6 months it had gone down to 1. And she could not believe it. Like, she just could not believe it, you know. And so when I say that I was sick, like, I was really that sick. Myron will testify. He'll tell you how sick I was. But so I have this amazing life today, and it's all because of AA. I mean, it's all because of AA, and it's all because I'm willing to do what it takes to stay sober. It continues to be the most important thing I do every single day. We had a guy, and I know there's another thing that we, you know, we go to meetings. We're not supposed to talk about what happens at other meetings, but, you know, we all do, so... Went to a meeting last night, and I got to see a guy pick up a 24-hour chip. And it was a guy that had picked up a 10-year chip in August. And he went back out. And I got to see him pick up his 24-hour chip last night. And we're all just one drink away. We're all just one drink away. And I remember being, I'm so grateful that he picked up that chip and that he's back in. But what I was even more grateful for a little bit was that he looked miserable. He looked absolutely miserable. He looked like it hurt. He looked like he was humiliated. He looked devastated. He looked sad. He looked like he was in pain. He looked like all those things that we are when we come in, that we have to remember why we came in. We can't afford to forget the pain. What is the reason you got here? Remember it. Remember it, because you don't want to repeat it. I mean, it's just that simple. And it's like, do what you've done every day that got you to where your life gets you when it's great. Like today, I have to do what I did yesterday and the day before. I have to do it today so that I can have it again tomorrow. Okay? Because that 10 years for that guy is gone, and he is miserable again. And we're all that close. We're all that close. That's it. That's all it takes. And it doesn't get better. It doesn't get better. We go back out there. I mean, maybe, you know, every once in a while you think maybe somebody went back out and drank for 20 more years and it was okay. But they don't come in and tell us, you know. But it doesn't happen. And we know that's not the reality of it, you know. So, you know, it's an amazing program. And I'm gonna end with a quick story. And because this is how I always close. So, again, if you've heard what I say, then you'll know it. But when I was 2 years sober, when I picked up my 2-year chip, there was a guy that that I had been in meetings with, but he and I had never spoke one-on-one. And he came up to me after the meeting, and he walks up and he says, you know, he says, it's so good to hear you share, and it's so good to see you pick up that chip. He says, because, you know, I've seen a lot of people come in and out of these rooms, and I got to tell you, when you came in, I honestly thought you were too late. Those are his exact words. He thought I was too late for Alcoholics Anonymous. And we don't hear that much. You know, and there was two things. I'm really glad that he didn't tell me that really early in sobriety, because that might have freaked me out just a little bit. But the other thing is, I'm really glad he said that, because every time I think about that, it brings me back to day one. It brings me back to just what I was talking about, that pain, that suffering that brought us in here. Okay, because here's the reality of this. We have these amazing lives today. We're not a lot. It's all great. It's wonderful. But out there, right now, there are countless of us who are still out there, and they are sick, and they are suffering. And for some of them, today will be too late. It just will be. It will be too late. But it's not for us. It's not for us, because today we woke up and we made a decision to live in the solution, and we made a decision to come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you all very much for letting me share.